several tweets and emails I've gotten claiming otherwise. I've also seen several pointing out that the only two that were expelled were black men under 30 who were outspoken about their dissent of certain bills that come up during session.
What happens next for these members who've been expelled?
Well, the two lawmakers expelled come from Democratic-leaning counties, and that could mean they'll be back in their seat before the end of the month. On Monday, Nashville's Metro Council is going to vote to seat a representative for the empty seat left by Jones, and several members on that council have already said they choose Jones. While I haven't heard what county commissioners in Shelby County, where Memphis lies, expects to do, I get the sense they do the same for Justin Pearson.
WPLN political reporter Blaze Ganey, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Some other news now. Israel's military carried out what it calls limited strikes on Palestinian targets, militant targets, Israel says, in southern Lebanon and in Gaza. These strikes come after rocket fire from both on Tuesday. Nobody was killed, and Israel is signaling that it would like to keep this situation from escalating. Here's military spokesman Richard Hecht.
Nobody wants an escalation right now. Quiet will be answered with quiet at this stage.
Although there's not a lot of quiet in the Middle East right now, Israeli officials say that somebody opened fire on an Israeli car and killed two people. Also, Israeli police have scuffled with Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, in the Old City, where worshippers are attending Friday Ramadan prayers. NPR's Daniel Estrin is nearby. Hey there, Daniel.
Hi, Steve.
What's it look like and feel like where you are?
You know, Steve, it's surprising. We weren't expecting this, but it's incredibly peaceful, at least the way it feels where I am in the Old City. I'm looking out at the Mount of Olives. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is in front of me. I watched thousands of Muslims stream out of the Old City after Ramadan prayers. Now you might be able to hear the call to prayer now. I mean, there were some minor scuffles this morning between police and Palestinians, but there is this real effort to keep things quiet. And, you know, I've seen Palestinian women selling herbs and a salesman blowing bubbles and tourists from Spain walking with a big cross to mark Jesus' footsteps on Good Friday, which is today. And, of course, Jews also celebrating Passover. All of this in this small area of the Old City of Jerusalem. So, you know, it's a reminder. This is also a moment of joy for many families gathering for holy days, but also an uncertain time.
Daniel, thank you for illustrating the value of sending a reporter to go look for himself or look for themselves. It's good that you're there and you're getting a perspective on this. So there were scuffles, but you're saying more broadly, things are peaceful where you are. For most people, they're going about Friday prayers as they would want to do. There was, however, this shooting in the West Bank. So this is away from Jerusalem, away from where you are. There was this shooting. What happened?
There was a drive-by shooting on an Israeli car, Steve. Two Israeli women in their 20s were killed. A third woman was wounded. This was in the occupied West Bank, so about an hour or two's drive from where I am, and there is a search for the shooter. But when I've been speaking to Israeli and Palestinian analysts, they are saying that Hamas in Gaza seems to be at the center of efforts almost for a year now to try to encourage a Palestinian uprising in these parts, in the West Bank and in Jerusalem. And Ramadan provides a perfect platform when you have all these heightened religious sentiments, and we're seeing some of that violence now.
So we don't know exactly who targeted this car or why, but I think you're telling us that is a question. Is someone trying to provoke something larger where you are? That's the question, right?
That's absolutely right. And, you know, it's just very unpredictable. We saw the strikes from Lebanon, rockets from Lebanon and Gaza yesterday. Israel responded. Now it seems like Israel's limited response was kind of designed to allow all the actors in this region, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas, even maybe Iran, to kind of step back from the brink. We're going to have to see. It's a very sensitive moment.
And NPR's Daniel Estrin is in Jerusalem. Thanks for your clear-eyed reporting. Really appreciate it.
Sure thing.
The Biden administration has released some details of its $15 billion response to drought in the Colorado River Basin. Yesterday in Arizona, the administration called it the largest investment in climate resilience in the nation's history. But new projects alone won't solve the crisis on the shrinking river. That will require sacrifice. From the California-Arizona border, NPR's Kirk Sigler reports on farmers who are facing water cutbacks for the first time in history.
For almost 100 years, Amanda Brooks' family has relied on the Colorado River near Yuma, Arizona, to transform this harsh brown desert into lush fields of green, growing abundant lettuce, spinach, kale, broccoli, and celery. This is where 90% of all the nation's winter produce is grown. Today, it's the end of the celery harvest. The old leaves and stalks crackle as we walk toward the edge of a field, which is also the edge of the state.
Yeah, so that levee is California. And right between us and the middle of that levee is the main channel of the Colorado River.
Brooks has watched with alarm as the river has shrunk in the last two decades. But until recently, it's mostly been business as usual across the seven states that rely on it. Farmers in Yuma are luckier in that they have senior water rights and aren't seeing their river water cut like in other parts of Arizona. But Brooks feels like her day is coming soon.
We would love to be able to farm using all the water that we have now, but we know there's not enough water to go around. And Yuma farmers are willing to help save the river where we can.
Yuma farmers say they're willing to leave water in the river to pause planting some of their land in exchange for money. And the latest plan the administration and its Bureau of Reclamation announced this week does include hundreds of millions of federal dollars to do that. Yesterday in Phoenix, White House advisor Mitch Landrieu, the former mayor of New Orleans, told reporters that the 40 million people who rely on the Colorado River can be assured the administration has their backs.
We have a 23-year drought in this country. That is not going to be fixed by a deluge of rain every now and then. We have to reorganize ourselves. We have to come up with new and innovative ways to deal with that.
Well, the West is coming off a wet winter, but it will do little to address the long-term drought. And this latest batch of federal funding won't be enough to keep the nation's two largest reservoirs, Lake Powell and Lake Mead, from reaching Deadpool, the point at which they're too empty to generate hydropower. Paul Brierley, who runs the Yuma Center for Desert Agriculture, is encouraged that Washington is finally taking this seriously.
You know, another way to look at it, we have a lot of natural disasters in the East, right, that are hurricanes and floods and tornadoes. This is basically a slow-moving natural disaster.
Scientists at this center have helped local farmers like Amanda Brooks double their yields in recent years while cutting their water use by about 20%.
This is celery that's already been harvested, and you can see they take almost everything out of there.
Brooks says it's hard to plan what to plant for next year with so many unknowns still.
You can make larger water cuts someplace else and not hurt the food supply like you would here in Yuma.
It's not yet clear whether farmers here will get federal payments to not use some river water or whether those will even be enough to keep them in the black.
It's almost unfathomable to think that the river could get to Deadpool. I mean, we've got to make some decisions and the Bureau's got to take some action so that we don't get to Deadpool.
The Bureau of Reclamation, that controls water here in the West, says it will announce a bigger picture plan next week for preventing Deadpool. In Yuma, this cloud of uncertainty is hanging over the annual county fair that's going on this week. A Journey cover band is warming up the crowd on opening night. Fairgoers are noshing on ears of roasted corn, green chili pork, and tortilla dogs.
It's very healthy.
Southwest farming towns like this are proud of their agricultural heritage. Their future depends on the river.
A lot of people think Yuma is just a desert area, you know. We are the winter vegetable capital of the world, I guess.
Drew Hughes is over in a noisy dairy barn helping kids show their calves.
Some of the farming communities, they are worried about the water coming up for next year. So with this season, it was a pretty good season, but it's going to be rough.
Rough, he says, as food prices here and everywhere else will only go higher. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Yuma, Arizona.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. Happy Friday. I'm Alex Crow. It's 8:19. We got Wisconsin Life coming up later this hour. Today, we'll be talking about a Fox Valley librarian who has created a monthly event at a local brewery to help even the busiest of people continue to be lifelong readers. WPR's Joe Schultz brings us that story in about 25 minutes in Wisconsin Life here on WPR.
If it's happening in Wisconsin, it matters to you.
Stay up to date on all the top news stories from around the state with WPR's new weekday morning podcast, Wisconsin Today. Subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts or at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today.
Support for WPR comes from U.S. Venture in Appleton, dedicated to having a people-first culture with a commitment to giving back to communities locally and globally. More information is at usventure.com. Finding a better way.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Budget a little tight? The agency can help save money on prescriptions, utilities, Medicare costs, and groceries. Boost your budget. Call to see if you qualify. 262-605-6646. Free and confidential.
In public radio, in weather, winds calming down today with highs in the 30s to 50s throughout the state. Chance for a wintry mix in central Wisconsin overnight into tomorrow. It could be some snow in the north as well, but it all melts off throughout the day with highs in the 40s to 60s. Sunday, even warmer, highs in the 50s to 60s. And how about this, in the 60s and 70s by Monday. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from iDrive, providing cloud backup, full system backup, and on-site iDrive appliance to protect PCs, Macs, and servers from data loss due to crashes and ransomware at iDrive.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from Workday, committed to helping organizations adapt to change, using real-time data to uncover insights, stay decision-ready, and prepare for whatever's next. The finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Not many people make it out of North Korea. The country seals its borders, and unless you go to sea, you can only escape to two neighboring countries, South Korea or China. Those who reach China have reached the territory of North Korea's only friend. The United Nations worries about what happens to North Koreans who did get out of their country to China. Could China send them back? NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports.
Kim Jong-ah served as a lieutenant in the North Korean army. She says if there's one thing she's always been good at, it's running away.
Hello, my name is Kim Jong-ah.
Kim defected via China to South Korea in 2009. She runs a YouTube channel about life in North Korea. She also heads a civic group that tries to reunite defectors with the children they left behind in China and North Korea. Kim herself was given away by her parents and adopted by another family. She first married at age 27, but claims her husband beat her, leading to the death of her second child. After divorcing her husband, she says she asked her adoptive father for help, but he refused.
My only reason for defecting was to take revenge on my adoptive father. I didn't know what was wrong with the North Korean system, and I was loyal to it.
In 2006, she crossed the Yalu River into China, leaving behind a daughter.
It took about a month after I crossed into China to be sold to my Chinese husband for 19,000 yuan.
That's about $2,375. Shortly after arriving in China, Kim found she was pregnant by her ex-husband and gave birth to another daughter. But Kim did not feel safe. She heard rumors that then-North Korean leader Kim Jong-il was set to visit China, which he did in May of 2010.
Whenever a high-ranking North Korean official visited China, they would ask for, say, 500 or 1,000 defectors, and China would immediately repatriate them as if it were a gift.
Kim feared she could be repatriated, so after more than 2 years in China, she fled once again, leaving another daughter behind. She paid brokers to smuggle her into Myanmar, then bribed local police to let her escape to Thailand and finally made her way to South Korea. From there, she called her husband in China and implored him to bring their daughter to join her.
I could hear my daughter's voice until then, but my Chinese husband was adamant He wouldn't listen to me and kept saying he would never leave China and threatened that I would never see my daughter unless I go back.
The flow of defectors coming out of North Korea into China has slowed to a trickle during the pandemic. And defectors whom China usually catches and sends back to the North have been stuck in China because North Korea won't take them back. UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in North Korea, Elizabeth Salmon, briefed the UN Human Rights Council on the situation last month.
Due to the border closures, over 1,000 of North Korean escapees have been detained in China indefinitely. Forcibly repatriated people are at risk of being sent to Guanliso, political prison camps.
She called on China not to repatriate the detained defectors even after the China-North Korea border reopens. Beijing, though, sees them not as defectors but as illegal economic migrants. At the UN, Chinese diplomat Jiang Han rebutted Salmon's remarks through an interpreter.
My government attaches great importance to protecting the lawful rights of foreign nationals in China and to suppressing trafficking in women and children. Those North Koreans who have entered China illegally are not refugees.
But Salmon says in an interview that their status doesn't matter. Under international law, she says, if people are deported to face persecution, torture, or other serious human rights violations, then...
The states are prohibited from transferring or removing individuals from their jurisdiction to a place where these awful things may happen.
Salmon notes that female North Korean defectors are particularly at risk because they're looking to escape North Korea, and Chinese men near the North Korean border are desperately short of marriageable women.
I think it's important that the particular situation of North Korean women fall into forced marriage or trafficking, or some others cross the border knowing that they will be forced to marry a Chinese man. But it's important to understand that they have no other choice to escape.
Despite international concerns, China is unlikely to allow defectors to stay or travel elsewhere. If China were to help North Korean defectors to get to South Korea, they could trigger a wave of defections that could destabilize the North Korean regime. So says Yoon Yeo-sang, chief director of the Database Center for North Korean Human Rights, a Seoul-based civic group. He notes that by using surveillance technology, video cameras and facial recognition software, China has already been able to drastically reduce the number of North Korean defectors entering the country.
Before COVID, we had at least 1,000 defectors arriving in South Korea annually. But last year, we only had 60.
And he says those numbers may not rebound even after North Korea lifts COVID controls. Yoon estimates that the number of North Korean defectors in China has dwindled in recent decades from around 100,000 to just 10,000, 90% of whom are now women.
It's not that North Koreans don't have the will to escape their country. It's because of the surveillance technology. Defection has become much harder, and in that sense, China has become the winner.
North Korean defectors' predicament is ironic in a sense because they're the only refugees in the world, Yoon notes, that are automatically eligible for citizenship in another country. That country is South Korea, but as Yoon explains, South Koreans see this issue differently.
Even though the peninsula is divided, we have lived together for thousands of years, so we see them as the people we will again live together with someday, not as foreigners or refugees.
Yoon says that's what motivates him to do his work. Defector Kim Jong-ah, meanwhile, says she's motivated by the quest to reunite with her children.
My birth mother gave up on me, but I will never give up on my daughters. And I can make this decision because I am alive. I think that's the biggest success that defection has brought me.
She's now been separated from her daughter in China for more than 13 years and her daughter in North Korea for nearly 17 years. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
This is NPR News.
Abbott Elementary is a fictional sitcom about teachers who have the odds stacked against them. And real-life teachers say it's not so far from the truth.
I can't believe they're actually talking about this on TV. Like, other people are going to watch this and see this. And, like, I think that's amazing. And I have to laugh, because if you don't laugh, like, you will cry.
Philadelphia teachers tell their thoughts on the show on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story plus the day's news from 4 until 6:30 today on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
Good morning, happy Friday. I'm Alex Crow, happy to be with you this morning on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:29, and news from NPR and WPR starts next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. The job market is showing signs of cooling as employers added 236,000 jobs in March. The unemployment rate fell slightly to 3.5%. That's the latest from the Labor Department, as NPR's Alina Selyuk reports.
The labor market has been surprisingly resilient in the face of the Federal Reserve raising interest rates, trying to cool off the economy and lower inflation. But new federal data show that the pace of hiring slowed in March compared to February. Still, employers are hiring more than they did before the pandemic in 2019, and the unemployment rate remains near a 50-year low for months now. Wages, on average, rose 4.2% in March compared to a year earlier. The Fed is particularly worried about the rising price of services, which is largely driven by growing wages, as job openings have outnumbered people looking for work. Alina Selyuk, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street, London, and Frankfurt markets are closed for the Good Friday holiday. At the close yesterday, the S&P 500 had gained 14. President Biden left the White House for Camp David yesterday. Before leaving, he vetoed a congressional resolution meant to overturn protections for the nation's waterways. The existing protections through an EPA rule protect thousands of small streams, wetlands, and other waterways. Republicans have long opposed the measure. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. Wisconsin manufacturers are well poised to become a global leader in the electric vehicle supply chain. That is, if more investments are made to train the workforce. That's according to a new report by the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. The report recommends working with technical colleges and increasing collaboration between researchers and industry. Missy Hughes is the CEO of the organization. She says small businesses in particular will need support in the transition to electric vehicle production. She says making the change will keep the state competitive.
We're not asking Wisconsin manufacturers to go to outer space and create a new market. U.S. manufacturers are already requiring these parts, and they're going to go someplace for them.
Wisconsin's automotive manufacturing sector currently employs more than 92,000 people. A liberal law firm is planning to challenge the legality of Wisconsin's voting maps. The Cap Times first reported yesterday that Law Forward is planning to file the lawsuit sometime after Supreme Court Justice-elect Janet Protasiewicz is sworn in on August 1st. The lawsuit will argue the current legislative and congressional maps were drawn based on partisan gerrymandering and violate Wisconsin's constitution. Protasiewicz suggested the current political maps are rigged during her campaign for the court. She defeated former conservative Justice Dan Kelly earlier this week, giving liberals a majority on the court for the first time in 15 years. A tie vote for president of Door County Village of Sister Bay was decided by a roll of the dice yesterday. NBC 26 reports Nate Bell will become president after his dice roll was greater than incumbent president Rob Zoski during a board of canvassers meeting. Zoski has a limited amount of time to request a recount. Without a recount, Bell will be sworn in for a two-year term later this month. Both candidates received 256 votes in Tuesday's election. Bell rolled a 6, by the way, and Zoski rolled a 2. In weather, highs in the 30s and 50s throughout the state today. Snow possible in the north, and central Wisconsin could see a wintry mix overnight. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting. Your Part-Time Controller helps nonprofit organizations with their accounting needs, remotely or in person. More at yourparttimecontroller.com. And from BritBox, with Sister Boniface Mysteries. Brilliant crime-solving nun Sister Boniface returns to solve curious cases in this Father Brown spinoff.
Available to stream at BritBox.com/NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The hot U.S. job market is a little less hot. We got a temperature check from the Labor Department this morning, which shows that employers added fewer workers in March than they did the month before. NPR Scott Horsley is here. Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
How much of a slowdown are we talking about?
Employers added 236,000 jobs in March. That's down about 90,000 from February. We've seen a gradual deceleration since the start of the year when we had that blockbuster month of hiring. But even with the slowdown, you know, 236,000 is still a pretty solid month for job growth. It's well above the average rate back in 2019, the year before the pandemic. And Neela Richardson, who's chief economist at the payroll processing company ADP, says, you know, some slowdown is not surprising in an economy that's already added well over 12 million jobs in the last couple of years.
Given where we are in the jobs recovery, you would expect to see a lessening of job gains. I think the story is, yes, we're finally seeing that downshift.
Keep in mind, the Federal Reserve has been trying to tap the brakes on the economy by raising interest rates as it tries to control inflation. And you can see the effect of those higher borrowing costs in today's report. Construction, for example, cut about 9,000 jobs last month. That's very interest rate sensitive. And manufacturing businesses shed about 1,000 jobs.
Well, given that, why would the Fed want to keep going in this direction?
Yeah, it seems a little odd, right? Most people think the more jobs you add, the better. But the central bank is worried that the job market has been out of balance. That is, demand for workers is outstripping the number of people available to fill those jobs, and that's pushing up wages. Of course, rising wages are good for workers, but they also have the potential to push up prices, especially in labor-intensive industries like restaurants and auto repair shops. One way to restore balance would be to have more workers come into the job market, and we are seeing some of that. 480,000 people joined the workforce last month, which is very positive. But Wells Fargo economist Sarah House says the Fed would also welcome some slowdown in demand for workers.
It's uncomfortable when we see the labor market weaken, but given how vexing inflation has been over the past 2 years, if we want to get inflation under control, some softening in the labor market is necessary.
Now, wage gains are slowing down. Average wages in March were 4.2% higher than a year ago. That's down from a 4.6% annual increase the month before.
Is hiring affected at all by the big economic news of last month, the two big banks that failed?
Yeah, that's not really evident in today's report, which measures employment right around the time that Silicon Valley and Signature Banks went under. But the fallout from those bank failures likely will have an impact in the job market in the months to come. You know, other banks have started to get stingier about making loans. That makes it harder and more expensive for businesses to borrow money. And as time goes on, House thinks that will be a drag on hiring.
Overall, you're going to see lenders get a little bit more conservative. We think it's going to contribute to a moderation in payroll growth in the coming months, and probably by the end of this year, looking at some outright job losses.
Some forecasters are warning that it could be that credit tightening that tips the U.S. economy into a recession later this year. Of course, employers are keeping an eye on those recession concerns, and that's another reason they might be cautious about bringing on additional workers.
And Pierre Scott Horsley, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
On August 30th, 2021, the U.S. completed its withdrawal from Afghanistan. As U.S. aircraft lifted off of the tarmac in Kabul, desperate Afghans clung to the plane. More than 100 Afghan civilians and 13 U.S. service members were killed in a bombing, and the exit left a vacuum that the Taliban swiftly filled. Congress will receive a detailed review of what happened during the 2 weeks that ended the two decades-long war. The public has a 12-page summary. Here to talk about the findings from that report is White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Good morning.
Good morning, Leila.
So what does the Biden administration say about what went wrong?
I mean, it doesn't say that much. I mean, the administration did acknowledge that they should have moved more quickly to get Americans and Afghans, allies out of Kabul. They also acknowledged that they didn't have the best intelligence about how quickly the Afghan National Security Forces would fold. But really, Leila, it places more blame on the previous administration for not planning a proper withdrawal. I spoke with John Gans. He's a former Pentagon official who has written about White Houses during times of war. And he says it is true that Trump left them in a very bad situation in regards to Afghanistan, but that the report is also more of a positive take on the Biden administration and doesn't really shine much of a light on where it fell short.
It did not take an active security clearance to know that the Trump administration had made a complete hash of the U.S. government and its engagement with Afghanistan. It did not take an active security clearance to understand that the Afghan army was in difficult straits.
You know, but of course, no president likes to talk about their failures, and Gantz called it a bipartisan tradition.
Okay, if Biden felt rushed or unprepared, why didn't he keep troops there longer or send in more?
I mean, the administration is really walking a fine line here. I mean, some top leaders testified to Congress soon after that they had recommended Biden keep 2,500 troops in Afghanistan. One general said pulling out troops would inevitably lead to the collapse of Afghan forces, which is obviously what happened. Mm-hmm. But in its report, the Biden administration argues that staying longer or sending more troops would not have changed the trajectory. And Biden has made clear, as we know, early on that he was not going to hand off the war in Afghanistan to a fifth president.
So it sounds like the plan was to leave no matter what. But this was an incredibly expensive war financially, but also in the loss of life and destruction of people's lives. And it feels like Afghanistan is back where it was. What did this war accomplish?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really tough question, especially for a lot of veterans. You know, National Security Spokesman John Kirby was asked about this yesterday at the White House briefing, and he says Americans did not serve in vain. He talked about accomplishing the original mission and how objectives evolved.
Just because the mission changed over time under previous administrations and leadership and scenarios doesn't mean that anybody who served in Afghanistan doesn't have something to be proud of. Doesn't have service to this country that they can take with them the rest of their lives and feel honorable about it.
You know, and he emphasized that Biden and the First Lady understand and respect their service.
Hmm. Now, this was America's longest war, and this report was highly anticipated. Will it bring any closure?
You know, I don't know. I mean, House Republicans, and probably not, House Republicans already started their own probe of the withdrawal, and it's going to be more critical than this, and you know it's going to be an issue in the 2024 election.
NPR's Franco Ordonez, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Alex Crow with you at 8:42 on this Friday. Wisconsin Life is right around the corner. Today we'll hear about a Fox Valley librarian creating a monthly event at a local brewery to help people continue to be lifelong readers. That story on Short Story Nights will be coming up in just a couple of minutes on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Rob Savage.
And I'm Mary Savage, and we're members of the WPR Signature Circle.
Wisconsin Public Radio really epitomizes the whole Wisconsin idea that we serve the whole public. What's really important is having that honest news broker. It's a great thing, and I want to make sure that that's there for however long we can make it be there.
For information about naming WPR in your will or trust, visit WPRlegacy.org.
Support for WPR comes from The Bolt Company, a family and employee-owned company dedicated to providing construction, technical, and real estate solutions in a variety of markets nationwide. Featured projects and more at Bolt.com.
This is Lily Maselli. I am the host of In Between the Music on WGTD HD1. My show is a blend of music and a bit of trivia. For dates and times, go to WGTD.org and click on Program Schedule.
At 8:44, here's some of what's happening in the news today. Two black lawmakers have been expelled from the Tennessee House after protesting on the chamber floor. One white lawmaker who also protested was not expelled. Wisconsin lawmakers from both parties are calling for an audit of state veterans' homes. This comes after former staff and volunteers provided detailed accounts Thursday of substandard care. Republican State Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahue says he has no plans to start using his chamber's new supermajority to impeach and convict state officials. Under the state constitution, it takes a majority vote in the assembly to impeach an official and a two-thirds vote in the Senate to remove them from office. In weather, highs in the 30s and 50s today. Central Wisconsin could see a wintry mix tonight. Northern Wisconsin could see snow. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive Nerve Relief. Nervive is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. At 8:45, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCullum with a story with a feature about Short Story Night.
Tons of people are in book clubs these days. Groups of friends get together to talk about a particular autobiography or critique a mystery novel's plotline or drink wine. Perhaps you're someone who wishes they could join a book club but says, how does anyone have time for this? If you are, there's hope, because a Fox Valley librarian has created a monthly event at a local brewery to help even the busiest people continue to be lifelong readers. WPR's Joe Schultz has more on how Short Story Nights have fostered a sense of community for 5 years.
A room with a small stage in Lion's Tail Brewing in Neenah is packed on a Monday. People from all walks of life filter into the brewery to discuss a different short story every month. A murmur begins to fill the room. Then, librarian Richie Zaporowski takes the stage with a microphone.
Hey, I'm Richie from the Neenah Public Library. Thanks for coming out, everyone. This is our fifth anniversary here. Yes. I'm here for 5 years, so let's give it up for 5 years.
Zaborowski hosts Short Story Nights. It's kind of like a book club, but instead of reading a book each month, the group reads one or sometimes a few short stories. Tonight, they're talking about a pair of short stories that center around second-generation immigrants.
This is a story about the mother trying to assimilate into the American culture in a different way, and the daughter...
Zaborowski had the idea for Short Story Nights shortly after becoming a parent. He had two small children at home and wanted to start a traditional book club, but just didn't have the time to read a whole book. He was too busy.
There's people who may not have time for a traditional book club, so this would be a perfect option for them.
Thus, Short Story Nights were born. During the event, Zaborowski leads a conversation about the book. There's also a trivia portion where attendees answer questions tied to the story's theme, and sometimes attendees even interview the authors of the short story they're discussing.
The Short Story Night really produced a great community. You hear about those third spaces all the time. Where can people get together nowadays? And this, I think, is a great third space for people.
Regular attendees agreed with Zaborowski's sentiments about the community forged discussing literature over adult beverages. A few of those attendees are Doug Middleton, Jill Harmon, and Mark Newman.
When I first came, other than this guy here, I didn't know anybody. You know, and I've gotten to know people, you know, the ones that are sort of regulars. It's always fun to sit at a table where I don't know anybody.
People come here from throughout the valley, and it's just a lot of fun seeing them again.
We get to, you know, visit with people, like-minded, you know, they're literary, and you get to talk about concepts. And, you know, I'm not watching college basketball, so it's a nice break.
Well, they all come for the camaraderie. Many admit that Zaborowski's infectious personality is what keeps them coming back. Just ask Harmon.
I'm a big fan of Richie's. He started out almost being a stand-up comic. He'd tell us jokes about his family.
For others, like Pat Rosnick, the back and forth between the audience and Zaborowski is what makes the event fun.
We love to come and give Richie a hard time.
And Zaporowski says the attendees are what keep him energized month in and month out.
I can't say enough about the group. They're just a great group, and they're a lot of fun. And like I said, no one takes it too seriously. We have a great discussion. everyone listens to each other and where they're coming from, and it's been wonderful.
Aside from the friendships forged, short story nights also give people of all perspectives the opportunity to talk about current events through the lens of literature.
Focusing on contemporary stories really allows us to have a conversation that spans all walks of life, and I think it is a safe space where people can get together and voice their opinions.
Whether young or old, rich or poor, Zaborowski says short story night is an accessible way to enjoy literature and forge friendships. And the adult beverages don't hurt either.
WPR's Joe Schultz brought us that piece on short story nights in Neenah. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And I'm Alex Crow. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Lily Maselli. I am the host of In Between the Music on WGTD HD1. My show is a blend of music and a bit of trivia. For dates and times, go to WGTD.org and click on Program Schedule.
WPR is pleased to support music in our communities. Details at WPR.org/events.
Thanks for joining us for Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Quick check of sports. The Milwaukee Bucks will play their final home game of the regular season tonight at 7 against Memphis. The Brewers will play the St. Louis Cardinals tonight at 7:10. And the Masters is back underway right now. In weather, highs in the 30s and 50s throughout the state today. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. You might not know what they look like, but you probably know the music they made. One more time, I'm gonna celebrate.
Harder, better, faster, stronger. When you decided to walk away.
That is Daft Punk, the now defunct house music duo from France who kept their faces hidden under shiny robot helmets. Thomas Bangalter was half of that group, and this is the music he's making now. Today, Bangalter releases his debut album of classical music titled Mythologies. Turns out a techno music composer writing classical music is not as much of a stretch as you might think.
In 2019, the French choreographer Angelin Prel-Jocage contacted me to write an orchestral score for a ballet commissioned by the Opéra National de Bordeaux in France. And it was an interesting coincidence because I was very attracted by the idea of writing for the orchestra and orchestrating myself.
So this is something that you've been thinking about doing.
Yes. I had with Daft Punk previously worked with an orchestra, and I really wanted to really write for the specific different instruments and do the orchestration myself.
I remember back when I was in my 20s going to raves, the whole point of why I loved it, because the music happened in a very spontaneous manner. So considering that that's how most people know your music, how do you kind of just extract yourself from that and create this?
When I think about spontaneity, it's about doing things in the moment and obviously writing 220 pages of sheet music and score for the orchestra is a long process, but at each page and each bar, I was trying to keep a fresh ear and a fresh eye about things to experiment and rules to break, going from techno and then here working with ballet music, but with the same love of contrast and oppositions in very sweet things and very violent things, going from one thing to another.
What was the most fun part about this for you?
I guess the most fun was my mother was a ballet dancer, and so I was raised in that environment with choreographer and dancing classes, and to reemerge and imagine the rhythms and the motifs for the dancers to dance to was fun. It was a quite solitary process, and when we got to the starting of the rehearsals and seeing these 20 dancers, 55-piece orchestra and all the technicians around, it became like more than 100 people to make this performance happen. It's fun. It's fun going from this aspect of solitude to a collective spirit.
What was the most frustrating part, the most difficult part about this?
It was like climbing a mountain. The piece is about 90 minutes long, and the first thing when you start with a blank paper is, how am I going to get there? You know, it's not even about how stylish you climb the mountain. It's really, are you going to be able to climb that mountain and give that music to the dancers? I guess the fact that it was all these mythologies in some kind of fragmented way was reassuring, because it had some narrative arc, but it was also pretty open. So it allowed a certain freedom and creativity that would take away the fear of the process.
How is the language of classical music different than electronic music?
It's a different way of looking at infinite possibilities. They are somehow a fixed palette with the orchestral music, but there's still an infinity of things you can do with that fixed palette. I've always loved, I think, constraints. In electronic music, there's some kind of an infinity of sounds available to you, and somehow that infinity of sounds become a little bit troubling and disconcerting, and you don't even know where to start.
Did I hear you right when you said that you love constraints?
I love some constraints because it's triggering creativity in an interesting way. I think in terms of the tools, to have some limitation has always been challenging and interesting at the same time. The other aspect which is fascinating to me is to get away from technology and closer to the, you know, human heartbeats.
Now, Thomas, I'm not going to ask you whether there's a chance in the future that Daft Punk gets back together, but is that music in your past now?
I think Daft Punk as a group and as a collective and as what we expressed and experimented is something from the past. But in terms of medium and ways to explore things, I've not thrown away the drum machines and the synthesizers that I was using. So I see more of the fact that this project that Guiman and I have been doing for almost 30 years is something from the past. And we're very happy and very proud and in peace with how fortunate we were to express ourselves so freely and how we were able to express what we wanted to express together.
It's good to hear that you have not thrown away the drum machines. That's composer Thomas Bongartaire. His album is called Mythologies, and it's out today. Thomas, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm Amy Martinez.
I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
What a way to finish the show. I'm Alex Crow here with you on Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to John Davis, who helps bring us the news each morning. That news on the way next.
Support for WPR's Mike Simonson Investigative Reporting Fellowship is provided in part by a gift from Frank L. and Mary E. Nicolay. The Mike Simonson Investigative Reporting Fellowship helps WPR provide in-depth news coverage throughout Wisconsin.
WGTD-FM is now available on your smart speaker. Simply say, play WGTD on TuneIn and hear WGTD programming. 24/7 Jazz is also available. Simply ask, play WGTD HD2 on TuneIn.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.